You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As it marks its 300th anniversary, Yale University is celebrating what it calls its long history of activism in the face of slavery. The abolitionist faculty members who befriended the slaves on the ship Amistad in 1839, and today the world's first center for the study of slavery. But in a research paper that was published last week, three Yale scholars say the university is ignoring a less honorable side of its history. They say Yale relied on slave trading money for its first scholarships, endowed professorship and library endowment. It honored slave traders when choosing figures to chisel as worthies on the tower at the center of its campus, and only 40 years ago chose the names of slave traders when it was naming some colleges. We're joined on the telephone right now by one of the students who did the study, Anthony Dugdale, who's a doctoral student at Yale University. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us exactly what you found?
Well, that a lot of Yale's initial financial endowments, perhaps unsurprisingly, were reliant on the slave trade, their first professorship, their first scholarship, their first library fund. Had ties to slavery. Second, we found that in 1831, the Yale officials played a very important role in preventing what would have been the country's first black college from being founded here in New Haven. And then third, and perhaps most surprisingly, was that in the 20th century, in the 1930s and 1960s, when Yale built its residential college system, and they looked to their history to find, to decide who should be honored with the names of those colleges, they chose overwhelmingly from the ranks of their pro-slavery graduates and did not choose from their more honorable abolitionist heroes. Actually, 9 out of the 10 colleges that are named for people are named for people who either own slaves or publish views in favor of slavery.
And what kind of controversy was going on at the time?
Well, I mean, the 1960s, you all know exactly what was going on then. I mean, Martin Luther King was marching. The civil rights movement was very active. And yet Yale chose to name a college after Samuel F. B. Morse.
Can you talk about Yale's attempt in the early 19th century to set up a black college and what happened?
Yeah, there was a white abolitionist, Simeon Jocelyn. He was actually the pastor of one of New Haven's earliest African-American churches, what's now Dixwell Congregational. And he had a vision for, opening up higher education for African-Americans. And so he went down to Philadelphia, where there was the first convention for free people of color, and got the whole convention extremely fired up about his vision of opening up a black college. They recommended New Haven as the site. He came up to New Haven really charged up and excited about opening up this college. And then he announced it on September 7th, 1831, in a speech in the center church in the middle of the green that he wanted to create this college here. And a bunch of Yale officials, mainly officials over at the law school, got together and put a stop to it. Had a town meeting that overwhelmingly rejected the college. And then afterwards, the newspaper reports, which is the best estimate we have as to figuring out exactly why this happened, basically reported that to have a college here that would attract more black people to New Haven would end up harming Yale, and that they did not want that to happen.
Can you talk about Kurt Schmoke, the former mayor of Baltimore's research into this, who is now a senior fellow on the Yale Corporation, the governing board of the university?
That's right. He wrote a senior essay on Dixwell Avenue Congregational Church, that church that I was mentioning, whose first pastor had the image for the black college. And he decried the shutting down of this black college very strongly. He was when he was here in 1971, he was a very strong activist and very active in the local undergrad activist community. And this is what he wrote a senior essay on. I haven't heard anything from him since then, but it was very interesting to come across that, whereas now he's effectively the chairman of the board of Yale.
And what about, Yale's history merging with American history, former Vice President John C. Calhoun?
Yeah. Well, if you were going to put together a list of the people most responsible for perpetuating slavery in this country, he would definitely be on the short list. He occupied national, federal political office for 40 years, from 1810 to 1850, crucial years in our country's history. And he was a South Carolina plantation master, and he really drove the state's rights and pro-slavery program throughout the country during that time. And then, again, in 1930, Yale chose both to put his statue as a worthy up on the Harkness Tower, and also to name a residential college after him, one of the highest honors that Yale gives anyone.
So what are you proposing right now, Anthony Dugdale, again, one of the doctoral students who did the report on Yale's connections to slavery?
Well, we in the report, we don't make any call for action. And we wanted to just report just the facts and just lay out the history for everyone to read, and then allow the community to make up its mind as to where to go next. My hope really is that the entire campus and the local community get actively involved in talking about these issues and in a dialogue about, you know, what should or could Yale do to make up for its role with the shutting down of the Black College, and then also who is it appropriate to honor on the Yale campus. I don't have any concrete answers for that, but I want to get the community involved in talking about that and those issues so that together we can come up with some kind of a response and work with Yale to do that.
Reverend Eric Smith also joins us on the line, pastor at the Community Baptist Church in New Haven and a member of a group working to create a reparations task force for the city of New Haven. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reverend Smith.
Good morning.
The city council just met. What did they decide about this reparations task force?
Well, it wasn't really a meeting of the city council. Back in June, there was a public hearing and a resolution that was passed by the Board of Aldermen saying that they supported Congressman Conyers' H.R. Bill 40, which calls for the creation of a commission to study slavery in America. As part of the public hearing that led to the passage of that resolution, it had been suggested that a local group be set up to study the role New Haven-based institutions have played in slavery. Several members of the Board of Aldermen expressed support for that, and they wanted the community to come together and present a proposal. Well, the community did that. We held a few meetings, talked about what we'd like to see happen. We presented it to the senior standing alderperson in the city, a man named Alderman Anthony Dawson. He wholeheartedly supported what we wanted to do. We had a meeting with the president of the Board of Aldermen, George Perez, and he, too, expressed his support for it and said he would be one of the co-sponsors. So both of them have come out and publicly supported the creation of this task force. And once we get through the primary season in September, we're going to continue to work with the Board of Aldermen to actually get this implemented.
Reverend Smith, what was your reaction as you read about this extensive history of Yale and slavery benefiting from the slave trade, beginning with its first professorship endowed by Philip Livingston, whom historians record as one of the biggest slave traders in the colonies? Today, the Livingston Gateway at Yale stands in his honor.
Well, to be honest, I had mixed feelings about it from the standpoint that I'm a graduate of the Divinity School, and I do some teaching at the Divinity School. But at the same time, I had a sense that there would be some history there, and our group intentionally didn't want to start targeting corporations until research had been done. And literally, probably about 4 or 5 days after we publicly announced our desire to have this task force created, the report came out. Now, I wasn't surprised, given Yale's 300-year history, that they had a role in slavery. I was surprised at the degree of it and the fact that it spread even into the 20th century. And clearly, some of the most egregious things for me was the whole issue of the Negro school in 1830s, and then even as late as 1960s, given the times that they were still naming buildings after prominent pro-slavery people rather than drawing on their history of abolitionism as well. So it was the kind of thing where it didn't surprise me entirely, but it was surprising in terms of the degree.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. A special shout out to KPFA listeners and to KGNU listeners, as well as those who are listening to us online at WBIX. You are listening to Democracy Now! Our guests are Reverend Eric Smith, as well as Anthony Dugdale. He's one of the doctoral students who have just published a study on slavery's links to Yale University on its 300th anniversary. Stay with us.
No more auction black for me. No more. No.
Listening to Democracy Now! On KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno. It's 9:39 in the morning, and we hope that you'll stay tuned for more. Up next at 10 o'clock, Music of the World with Kutai Darren Kwai.
Listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the connections between Yale University on its 300th anniversary and slavery, the report that graduate students put out last year document how Yale benefited from the slave trade, beginning with its first professorship endowed by Philip Livingston. Livingston Gateway at Yale stands in his honor. Similarly, the first scholarships were endowed by profits from a plantation worked by slaves in New England. And the scholarships, as well as a college, are named for the plantation owner, George Berkeley. A plaque in the college lauds his effort to establish a college in Bermuda. According to Berkeley papers examined by the report's authors, the college was to be a place to evangelize captured American Indian boys, or as the papers call them, such savages as are under 10 years of age. 10 of Yale's 12 residential colleges are named after prominent men in Yale's history. Of the 10, 8 owned slaves and 4 published or sermonized in favor of slavery. We're going to turn now to Professor John McWhorter. I was able to speak with him last night about his reaction to the study. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, and asked him his response to the Yale report and also why he thinks he was misquoted in an op-ed piece by Henry Wincik, who will join us afterwards, that was in the New York Times this weekend, called Yale and the Price of Slavery. This is Professor McWhorter.
Well, my response to the Yale report is that while it's very important that we unearth and acknowledge information showing that there were roots in slavery in various institutions that still exist today, that it is somewhat simplistic of us to render judgments upon the worth of people's entire lives based upon the fact that they owned slaves at particular times. And the reason that I say that is because these societies were, or to be more specific, our society was one, where the inherent inferiority of African-American people was an accepted fact in the thinking of most even educated white people. That is, from our perspective, horrific. However, this was the truth of that time. And just as in our time, there are only certain gifted people who are able to see beyond what they have known since childhood. So my response to the Yale article was simply that if we're considering basically denying the worth of the people on these buildings' lives and possibly stripping them from Yale's buildings, what I said in the article, verbatim, was, it's downright inappropriate to render a moral judgment on the worth of a person's life based on moral standards which didn't exist at that time. Now, in the, in itself, very interesting response that Professor Vinchik presents on Saturday in the New York Times, he quotes me somewhat differently. What he says is, John McWhorter says that slavery, when those people lived, was largely an unquestioned part of existence. It's downright inappropriate to render a moral judgment, based on moral standards which didn't exist at that time. Now, that makes it sound like I'm saying that we cannot render any kind of moral judgment upon people who owned slaves in the past, and that's certainly not what I said. What he leaves out in that ... is not something niggling, but something very specific. What I said was, it's downright inappropriate to render a moral judgment on the worth of a person's life based on moral standards, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm saying is simply that if we're going to look at Thomas Jefferson, he was a slave owner. This was a disgusting thing, and I think that this should be widely publicized. It would be an abomination if we did not publicize that. However, Thomas Jefferson was also someone who fought vigorously for the very kind of ideology which was the direct predecessor to the Democratic Party ideology and the liberal ideology, which I have reason to believe that Professor Wienchik would espouse and which I espouse too, which is to say that when we're evaluating Thomas Jefferson, we can't let the slavery issue just be the one deciding factor on figuring out what the worth of this person's life was to the American Republic and to our lives today.
What about the point that the professor makes about, for example, George Washington, who recognized that it was wrong to have slaves, who at the end of his life said that his slaves should be free, and that if he recognized it, then why should he be exonerated? Or the beginning of the piece where he talks about Robert Hairston, who wanted to bequeath his entire estate to the child he finally admitted was his, who was a slave.
Sure. Well, what we find in the Hairston story, which is a very interesting one, is that, as should not really surprise us, there were people who could see further ahead, and this person was one of them. However, what that story also shows is that most people could not, and even his own heirs, who presumably loved him very much, simply could not see leaving money to someone who they unjustifiably, but nevertheless quite firmly, regarded as an inferior human being. And ironically, as far as George Washington, I find myself arguing with Professor Wienchik. People like Washington had other ways of supporting themselves. You know, it's one thing for Washington to be able to think that this is not the best thing and to free the slaves, but for one thing, he does it after he's gone. And Washington was a rich man who married a rich widow. So, of course, he can afford to make these kinds of distinctions and to do the right thing. But let's face it, the vast, vast majority of slaveholders at the time, North and South, did not do such things, which is not to excuse them, but which is to say that this was a society which was very different from ours. For example, let's imagine, you know, briefly, we probably would have a hard time sitting down to dinner with most dead people who are famous today who were men, because we would read them as rabid sexists. This is a serious problem. We could not get through an ordinary conversation based on their beliefs. Yet it would be hard for us to say that we should condemn every single male person, and this is actually white and black men, and all the accomplishments that they gave us based on the fact that they were prey to an ideology which was largely unquestioned at the time. Of course,
That is John McWhorter. He is a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. I reached him by phone last night to talk with him about his reaction to the Yale study that links the university and its 300th anniversary to slaveholding in the past. We're joined on the telephone by Professor Henry Winsek, who is writing a book about George Washington and slavery, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for for his book, The Hairstons, An American Family in Black and White, and did a piece on the Yale study that appeared this weekend in the New York Times op-ed section called Yale and the Price of Slavery. Your response to Professor McWhorter, Henry Winsek.
At the outset, I should say I am not a professor. I am an independent writer. I live almost in the shadow of the University of Virginia, but I'm not a professor there. When I quoted Professor McWhorter in my piece, he's correct that I did leave out a phrase, but that was inadvertent on my part. I was quoting a portion that had been quoted earlier in the New York Times. He raises a but his response is very interesting, and I don't think that it weakens the basic point that I made. I think that we do have a right to question the morality of the decisions of those people regarding slavery, because I disagree with Professor McWhorter that slavery was accepted by those people at that time. That's one of the things that has really driven my research into the Hairston family of slaveholders and into the founding generation. I think when you look below the surface of their public pronouncements and you look into their private dealings and their private papers, you can see that they indeed wrestled with the morality of slavery. One of the keys of to understanding this, I think, is, oddly enough, the blood ties between white and black communities. Those ties were very carefully kept hidden. And this brings up the whole question of the slaveholder's perception of the slave as a human being. You will see very often in writings about slavery that, well, they didn't even understand that the slaves were fully human. And I don't think that's correct. If you look out into your fields or you look across the dining table to the servant who is standing at the other end of the room, and you see that person resembles you because he is your nephew or he is your cousin or he is your son, you have an immediate vision of the humanity of that person. And you, because blood crosses racial lines, and that's why I think that this whole question of, well, how did they perceive the African Americans is a false question, because the whites were able to cover up these connections so successfully.
And what about on the issue of someone like Thomas Jefferson, about what you call the presentism defense?
Well, I think when you look at Jefferson's writings, you see, again, a man who was almost torn in half by the question of enslaving people. On the one hand, in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, he catalogued all of the supposed ways in which blacks were inferior to whites. But then, right after he wrote that section, it's as if he had this sudden, almost mystical vision of the evil that he was putting onto paper. That's where he wrote that passage that I quoted in the New York Times when he said, suddenly, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice will not sleep forever. He knew the evil of what he was saying and the evil of what he was doing. And later on, I mean, Jefferson actually came up with a gradual emancipation scheme, but it didn't work out. I mean, he knew that we had to find a way to end slavery, but later in life he abandoned that plan. I think that when you look carefully at the writings and the acts of these people, you see a much greater knowledge of the evil of what they were doing than we think. And the Hairston story that I wrote in the Times, I think, really speaks to this directly, because it shows how, in so many ways, it was money that trumped morality. We have to understand that the slaves, in many cases, ownership of slaves constituted the greatest source of wealth for a Southern family. And no matter what misgivings they had about owning black people, they wanted to keep it up because that was where their money came from. And it was a very basic conflict. And I think in Washington's case, I mean, he decided to do away with it in his family as far as he could. He wanted to set all of his slaves free, which would have cost his heirs thousands of dollars But he made the decision at the end of his life that slavery was so repugnant that he personally could not allow it to continue. He coupled that with a vision that the slaves, if educated and trained, could enter into Virginia society as fruitful and productive people. That was a revolutionary vision, and it's really tragic that, in many cases, that was not allowed to happen.
Henry Winsick, explain what presentism means.
Presentism, in a nutshell, means that we can't look back on the past and judge people by our standards. We can't look back and judge people by standards which did not exist at that time. And certainly, you will find eloquent defenses of slavery going back to the earliest moments of our colonial past up until today. I mean, you will find people today defending the morality of slavery, even though we know that it was wrong. And this is one of the great ironies of the debate over this, is that people will today will look back at the founding generation or even at the Confederates and say, well, they didn't know what they were doing. And how they could defend those people really puzzles me, because it's as if they're defending Pharaoh instead of standing with Moses. I mean, we should look back on that era with a great deal more regret than we do.
I wanted to get the response of Reverend Eric Smith to what Professor McWhorter said and to Henry Winsick's arguments right now about whether you can judge people 100 and 200 years ago against the standards of our time. Henry Winsick is saying, in fact, these standards may well have been the standards of many back then as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of responses to that. I mean, first of all, when we focus just on the American viewpoint as to whether or not it was a moral standard in the past, it once again serves to dehumanize the mindset of the Africans who were brought here. I'm sure if back in the 1700s, 1600s, 1800s, you were to ask the Africans who were brought here and enslaved whether or not this was an immoral act, I'm certain that they would tell you yes. So first of all, I mean, I think that it further dehumanizes African-Americans to deny the fact that just because it's a moral standard for people present back then in America does not mean it's a worldwide moral standard for everyone. But furthermore, when you sit back and look at what was happening once emancipation came about and they started to establish organizations like the Freedmen's Bureau, organizations which were meant to basically provide economic opportunity for African-Americans, and you see some of the arguments made regarding why it was needed, it becomes clear. People back in the 1800s recognized that this was a moral wrong committed against African people, and that through creating the Freedmen's Bureau, it was a matter of justice for ex-slaves. So I think, once again, I have no choice but to agree with Henry Winsick about this, that the moral standard was there. They recognized what they were doing was wrong, and the establishment of the Freedmen's Bureau was an attempt to right that wrong. And that whole process itself sets the foundation for slavery reparations today, because the promise of the Freedmen's Bureau was never fulfilled.
Anthony Dugdale, what do you plan to do on campus right now?
Well, first let me respond to Mr. McWhorter also in saying that he misses the point of our study, which was that many of these decisions were made at Yale in the 20th century, presumably, you know, in the 1960s, with people who shared at least some of our moral sensibilities. And so, you know, he can't just shift the full burden of these decisions into some distant past that was, for some reason, where people were morally completely different creatures than we are today. I don't think that works. On campus, I think we need to hold, some larger discussions. I think it shouldn't be limited just to the campus. I think it's crucial that the New Haven community be brought into the discussion, because a lot of these decisions really affected the entire New Haven community and not just Yale. But that, you know, when the undergrads get back, I think in about a week, a number of them have been contacting me, and I'm sure that they will have views that they'll want to make known and things that they'll want to do. I expect the discussion to just kind of explode all across the campus as everyone talks about it with wildly different opinions, I'm sure.
I want to thank you all for being with us. If people want to get more information on your report, where can they go on the web?
www.yaleslavery.org. And the whole report is there together with a number of press clippings.
Well, thank you all for being with us, and this all set against the backdrop of the major UN conference against racism that's going to be taking place in Durban in the beginning of September, and we'll be bringing you specials from there every day, so do stay tuned. That does it for today's program. Anthony Dugdale, Reverend Eric Smith, and Henry Winsek, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro, and engineer Errol Maitland, our technical director. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, as well as all of our affiliates. All of that, of course, means all of you. We are Pacifica. Today, we're broadcasting from downtown community television in the landmark firehouse, Engine 31, in Chinatown. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!